Welcome to the Mumbrellacast, sponsored by cradiodifferently.com. I'm Tim Burrows.
And I'm Colin Delaney. This week,
the Logies and the danger of embargoed press releases.
The Ad Standards Bureau's latest quirky complaint.
Dare buys a whole ad break.
Rob, I reckon a lot of Aussies watching this right now can relate to your problem. Luckily, I also reckon that Dare iced coffee can fix it.
Unreal.
More like unreal.
The week in film.
And has Nine finally found itself some momentum?
I want to be able to help you as a girl who's been 18 and had some pretty extraordinary things in the best way I can.
Now joining us today in the studios of CBS Interactive is former Mindshare boss John Petropoulos, now MD of Barter Company Miramar. Hey John.
Hi there fellas. Hi Tim.
And former Mindshare underling, Kathy McGinn.
Hello.
We're having a Mindshare loving.
And your producer is Colin Delaney.
Howdy.
Now, welcome to the podcast, John. I think it's your first podcast with us, isn't it?
It is my first podcast.
Now, in a moment we'll talk a bit more about what you're doing now. You're former COO and then CEO at media agency Mindshare.
Correct.
Why the change of career direction?
Well, okay.
Do you consider it a change of career, don't you?
Oh, yeah, look, I do. I do most definitely. From one perspective, you know, 25 years in a media agency environment or an advertising environment in terms of a pure sense was a long time. And to be quite frank, you know, leaders of business in any sort of industry need to make changes and move on when basically the business is about to change. Mindshare was going through a different phase, and from my perspective, it was time to move on, and I wasn't actually the right person for that new phase.
What got you into the media industry in the first place?
Bewitched. No, I'll be frank, it was.
That was because her husband worked in the agency.
Yeah, that's right.
Didn't he? Was it? I won't say Sterling Cooper, but that's Mad Men, isn't it?
No, that's right. No. That came later on. I saw none of that, by the way. I came out of university looking for something to do, did the normal stuff, 25 interviews ranging from Alcoa through to marketing departments, and then I walked into a place called Darcy McManus, Macias, Benton and Bowles, which does not exist anymore.
What was the acronym for that? Anything
DMB
decent?
DMB.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And then it became Macias. Mm. And to be quite frank, I thought, Bewitched. They're a bit like Bewitched. They're in advertising. And walked in. There was 120 people there, two receptionists, awards on the table. And I went, no, it's nothing like that. And I've always maintained if you've got a passion for something, which is, you know, I'm going to state the obvious, but if you've got a passion for something, you stick to it. And 25 years later, I was running one of the biggest agencies in the country, if not the world.
And media people, I kind of think always inherently they either have a strategy brain or a trading brain. Which one would you fall into? Do you
yeah,
think?
Well, okay. All the strategists thought I was a trader. I thought I was a strategist.
That's with a D. Trader.
That's okay, right. Yeah. I thought I was a strategist, but look, at the end of the day, I probably did fall into more of a trading sort of space,
which I suppose is lucky for your new role, really.
Correct. I mean, it is effectively a trading environment.
Yeah, it's probably worth, you know, maybe the elevator pitch on what bar. So Miramar, what they do is barter.
Yeah, they do media barter
now,
specifically.
Not everyone will understand what that is, so it's probably worth doing the
elevator
pitch.
Yeah. Well, you know, and that's part of the reason I took on the role. To be frank, it's probably been misunderstood, misused, and abused over the last 20 odd years. Miramar struck me in terms of the company itself, in terms of the way they do things. They do things quite differently. In the past, I probably have to give you a little bit of history. In the past, they tended to basically work in excess stock environments. As part of that, provide goods and services of that excess stock to exchange for. Basically anything.
And how does that work in practice?
Well, the practicalities of it were probably great 20 years ago, because you could actually just, you know, offload it somewhere like Fiji,
right, for example. Yeah.
And then provide a, you know, whole bunch of trade credits, and as a result of that, you do deals with the media owners or hotels or whatever.
So you've overproduced, I don't know, too much washing powder or something.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
you just
yeah.
Ship it off to another market. Or was how it used to be done.
Yeah, yeah. And then as part of that, you got exchange. You created an exchange. Now, it makes perfect sense to use goods or services that have an inherent margin built into them in exchange for something else, because it means it's cheaper.
Mm. Mm. By margin, what you mean is the difference between the cost of producing it and the list price.
That correct, yeah. Go on.
Sorry, I was just going to ask, while it's a system that you shouldn't be ashamed of or anything like that, do you find that companies may want to keep it a bit quiet because they don't want to seem to have excess inventory?
Yeah, totally. I mean, one of our biggest issues, we can't, shout from the rooftops some of the great stuff we do with particular clients. And, our clients range from the normal airline, auto, to utilities, financial services, and some of the best brands in the world. I don't mind saying we do stuff for, Estee Lauder, for example, and Levi's and fashion houses. What Miramos is better at doing is it actually is more in the space of business development. So creating budgets that can enhance a company's ability with us to get into new retail channels. So there's two fundamentals there. Utilizing goods and services to create a budget and then also finding retail channels that they may not have.
How does the media and marketing world use your service?
Oh, look, we're dealing with a handset at the moment. The handset, and it's not excess stock at all. The handset is in the digital space. It's only going to do a digital campaign. I said it had a certain amount of money for a digital campaign. Happens to be Asia Pacific as well. So our remit is as broad as that, if need be. Their key objective is they've got this handset, which is the bee's knees, the next upgrade. So the exchange or the trade or the corporate trade or the barter or whatever you might want to call it, from our perspective, is get it into hands of early adopters and senior executives. So we'll look at key sectors, entertainment being one, and also key industries where, we can deliver these handsets. And that adds a marketing overlay and a branding overlay to what we do.
But in exchange, those places where you're placing it, they'll still give something back as well. Airtime or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the model from our perspective. We get we get inventory in exchange, or we get other elements that are tradable, whether they're hotel rooms or airline tickets. They're the most obvious, but we've dealt in energy and minutes for telcos as well. So,
you guys have just opened a Melbourne office.
Yes.
Who's heading that up?
Well, at the moment, it's me. Okay. we're just, in fact, on Friday, I'm interviewing some candidates to put another person in. We've got three people in Sydney. With that, we'll have two in Melbourne. So we'll, within the matter of 12 to 15 months, we've gotten to about six people. So I'll let you know at a later date who that might be.
Yeah, right.
Now, you touched on this a little bit earlier, you're sort of saying, the point you sort of left mindshare, because the changes were coming ahead for the agency. With the benefit of being able to sort of step back slightly from the agency world and still watch it, how do you see the changes in the last few years? What have been the big changes?
Yeah, look, it's a really interesting question because from my perspective, it's your perspective on it is, as an outsider, is somewhat different. I never thought it would be, but it obviously is. Fundamental change. Look, a tough period in terms of the last 2 to 3 years. So a lot of the changes that those media agencies are quite clearly attempting to do have been stymied to a degree because of GFC, global advertising pulling back, etc. But I always felt it would become full service to some degree. And that's purely because of the digital space requires content development, probably of a different nature. If I talk about the 30-second TVC, you're going to say, everybody's talking that doesn't really exist to the degree it does. But It's going to be interesting in terms of the advertising industry, who makes the play to understanding that content in a digital environment as well as a normal television environment or at a home environment, how they all interplay. And there'll be a natural land grab for content development.
And do you think that will come just out of media agencies, or will we see ad agencies trying to sort of grow in that direction?
I'm in two minds. Look, my background would suggest that media agencies are more experienced in terms of what eyeballs, what clicks are actually, what reaction consumers have to content, because that's their part of their role. And as a result of that, they'll be able to create content and develop that within their service offering. I think did Interbrands just get into a creative agency?
Yeah, they've just bought a sort of a small creative.
Media Brands, yes. Right. Yes.
Yeah,
which gives them, I don't think they're ever going to be all singing, all dancing full service, but it's another kind of weapon, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think that's another key. Let's not forget, part of the weaponry is to create revenue.
Mm.
And the squeeze on media agencies has been and will be and will continue to be quite tight. So you just got to naturally provide services, and content is one of those.
Now, Kathy, in your sort of time at Mindshare, did you get the sense that this was something that is right there through all of the ranks, this thinking that we're going to grow and we're going to go in these directions? You know, in other words, has it sort of permeated all the way through, or is it something that still sort of sits at CEO and you know, kind of board level, that they'd like to do these things?
Yeah, I think that's probably a fair call. And I think, I mean, you touched on the sort of the perpetual divide between buyers and strategists, which I think media agencies are trying to sort of bring closer together and resolve that sort of disconnect. But as yet, I think there's not been a cohesive way of thinking how that will actually work, how buyers will be more strategic and strategists will better understand the business of buying. I think that's a big...
Mm. If you were going to launch a media agency now, John, what model would it be? How would you set it up? Or were there better places to be these days, do you think?
No, look, I mean... I do think strategy per se, or communication planning or branding or strategy, brand strategy in a communication environment, is probably the right end of the scale. I think I personally would take on a digital agency that's quite strong in that, and then culturally and within that make a change so they can be broader in their thinking. Because the one issue with digital agencies or digital specialists per se is they're pretty confined in their thinking. They don't actually think beyond their space. And that you know, that's what they're paid to do. This, mind you, the space is all-encompassing and ever-changing. So,
now, Kathy, you've also worked at a digital agency.
Well, I was going to say, I think that the reverse is true, that actually it's very difficult for non-digital thinkers to sort of start to understand how to transfer that sort of, you know, communication planning, because everything is digital, actually. You know, we're not dealing with a landscape in which you can have isolated non-digital elements.
But do you think people in a digital agency understand the world beyond digital, though, when it comes to the trading environments and those sort of things?
What is the world beyond digital?
Well, I'm talking about the trading world beyond digital. Or is that literally you were unaware that world existed?
Doesn't exist. Hang on while she looks at her Twitter account.
It's all pixels. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but you worked at Reading Room, for instance. Now, if you talked to your average colleague there, would they have had a clear picture of what was going on in a media agency or an ad agency? Or was it all a bit of a mystery?
But, I mean, there are digital agencies and digital agencies, and I think...
Diplomatically put, I think we'd better move on.
I think you're right, Kate, but I think you've got to infiltrate those agencies with thinkers beyond what they have.
That's quite a sinister way of putting it, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It is. But it's viral to a degree. You need some of that culture. Because I think the other way is harder to do, because the bottom line of it, to be quite frank, you talked about trading. You know, in a number of client meetings, services, pitches, great strategy, great integrated approach, lovely content, well done. What's the price?
The bottom line is the bottom line.
Yeah, which is what I'm seeing more and more in the current role.
Next. Did the Herald Sun leak the Logies?
There's more to radio than music through your headphones.
Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan MicroCitizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone all-time prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
On Sunday's TV quote-unquote Night of Nights, not to be confused with A Good Night of TV, the Logies were held. Among the awards handed out, Hamish Blake won the coveted Gold Logie. Anticipation was somewhat killed, though, for those on social media when the Herald Sun inadvertently exposed the results more than an hour before Blake took the stage. Tim, it was a bit more complicated than that, though, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, you say anticipation was killed. I say enormous relief as the broadcast did go on until sometime the other side of midnight.
So, well, Carl, in that last hour, Carl was swigging red wines a little more than earlier, so maybe he knew.
Yeah, no, certainly by, I was watching the broadcast, and by about quarter to 11, when I think it was about then that the word started to go around on Twitter that, that Hamish Blake had won and the Herald Sun had leaked it, apparently, at that. At that stage, it was quite a relief just to think I can just go to bed now if I want to. The complicated bit, though, is how it leaked. It seems that certainly it wasn't a deliberate leak. You know, it wasn't just hey, we've got it first, we're going to stick it up. Because the way it works is with a lot of events with stories every day, but certainly with awards, to catch newspapers' deadlines for the next day because you want it to be in the paper the next day, you give them the results under embargo. And it looks like what happened was they were testing their iPad edition, which is a fairly new addition to the newspaper's armoury, and momentarily something went live on that edition, which was indexed by Google, because you know there are kind of protocols you can do to tell Google don't index this bit, and they clearly failed to do that. So then, if you were searching, maybe Google on the Logies, maybe Google News, up would have come Hamish Blake wins the Gold Logie, and of course people who click through then would have seen that story. And this is where I still don't think the Herald Sun has really got its story straight. At that point, you'd have linked through to a part of the Herald Sun website that they didn't want you to see, but still on the Herald Sun website, where that story, that iPad edition story, was sitting. So where it all became messy and what should have been a 12-hour embarrassing story, apologise and move on, became a 36-hour story, was they tried to claim it never appeared on the website. You know, so they
also threw some blame to Google.
They did. Well, they started off by blaming 9MSN by making the point that 9MSN were the only people who deliberately reported Hamish Blake's name, because 9MSN did a story about the fact that it had been leaked by the Herald Sun.
Right.
So, which obviously is kind of tricky for 9MSN because, you know, one of the owners is Nine, who were the host broadcaster. But they also, and it got more entertaining when Simon Prister was on Triple M the next morning and sort of described that Google had somehow got into their systems and found an unpublished story, very much sounding like, yeah, Google had done something wrong, which I think there was, for more digital people, there was just some sort of chuckling about, but still insisting that they'd never published it on their website. You know, We did, you know, I did a call out on Twitter saying, has anyone got any screen grabs of it on the Herald Sun? And I, you know, immediately had an email back from their PR saying, you're not going to find any because there aren't any out there. By which point, two or three had come in. So I had to then sort of email that across and say, well, look, are they fake? You know, they were published, you know, last night at 10:30. So yeah, they eventually sort of did apologise and did say it wasn't Google's fault, but still continued. And to this day, they insist it never appeared on their website. And I think what they mean is it never appeared on their homepage. Right. And did, but you know, it's a schmozzle.
Mm.
Can I ask a question on that? The you talk about embargoes. Embargoes have been, you know, around for forever. You know, in terms of you talked about the deadlines with print mediums. Is there a need for embargoes these days with the digital?
Do you know what? I think it's a really good question because I think there's a weakening need. I mean, where you sometimes see it useful is say it's quite a complicated report or something that you're publishing. And what you don't want is just journos all racing to be first to publish it 10 yeah. minutes after it's published. So you can see there's an argument for saying, OK, you can have it a day early so that you can read it properly, digest it, and then have something written sensible to publish. Yeah, much the same way that, for instance, the magazine and newspaper circulations, the ABCs, yeah. are generally released under embargo to the trade press and to all of those, you know, all of those involved on the media owner side a couple of days in advance, so that when the stories go up, they're a bit considered, and the media owners in question have had a chance to actually have a think about what they want to say and what the stories they want to tell are, and all of those things. But I mean, I'd say it's not an imperative anymore. But you know, I mean, I suppose a good case to think of recently was the Finkelstein, the Independent Media Inquiry. When they reported, they just put it up at a certain time and there it was. And, you know, I must admit, I raced to get some coverage up within minutes. And this is a 200-page report. So it was a massively quick skim, pick three or four paragraphs that leapt out that were interesting, get a holding story up, then go back and do a bit more. Within an hour or two, I'd already written an opinion piece based on the little bits I'd had. Yeah. And really, you know, I only felt I was doing it justice properly 24 or 48 hours later. You know, I didn't pull back from the views I'd had or the angles, but I know I would have told it better if I'd had a few hours to digest it first.
Yeah.
So, I think there is the race to be first. And, you know, online traffic, you know, first usually beats most insightful, unfortunately.
Yeah,
you know?
So
I kind of... There is a need, but you know, if I was organising an awards, I'd be really nervous about releasing stuff under embargo because to me the risk outweighs the reward.
Yeah, and Nine wouldn't have been all that excited. I haven't looked at the ratings actually.
They were good.
Yeah, they were still
strong.
Yeah. Okay. So
yeah,
We get these embargoes quite a bit. Will this change protocol, do you think?
As I say, it might a bit. I mean, you know, certainly we've seen the Logies sort of signalling they'll look at it. And I think more to the point, what it will do is anyone who organises an awards event or anything like that will probably have a think to themselves, gosh, you know, it could happen for us. Is it worth it? I think some people will probably hold back. But what will probably happen is, you know, even if they did pull back for a year or two, they'd miss out on the coverage in the... you know, in the print editions the next day, soon enough, you know, that would bring them back in line.
Well, the other problem is, which I witnessed at the Commercial Radio Awards, was that if an award ceremony is running overtime and you've set your embargoed story for, you know, they've said 10:30 and you say, okay, tick, 10:30 it is, but they're running over and they always, of course, leave the best awards till last, well then... boom, it's gonna be up at 10:30. Whoever's won, Hamish and Andy have won for their radio show, but they haven't been up to get their award. Oh, poor old Hamish always gets his.
Yeah. I had a similar thing at the Orgies, the Australian Writers Guild Awards, where we had a story time to go up on Encore of the winners' results. And it was one of the longest awards ceremonies I've ever been to in my life. And it was, they'll do some and then they'll have the starter and then some more awards. Yeah, and, you know, and it stretched on for something like 4 hours. And I was getting quite nervous because the agreed embargo time was close. And I kind of went over to the press office and I'm feeling quite nervous about this. I think, and they're like, oh, it'll be fine. And it was, you know, probably the story was up 10 minutes before the last one. But, you know, nobody knew to actually go on the site at the time and have a look. And you know the organisers were relaxed enough themselves. So, but yeah,
it wasn't too relaxed at the media table at the CRA. Awards.
In terms of the winners from the Logies, which networks have got the most to be smiling about?
Well, it was the public broadcaster that came out on top. ABC took most awards and this is sort of slightly controversial one, I guess, because Asha Keddy won an award for most outstanding or maybe most popular actress, in which she was awarded for both Offspring and Paper Giants.
Which is 10 and ABC.
Yeah, so sort of ABC got 6.5, while 10 got 2.5, and 9 got 6 awards. So, you know, the ABC trumped 9, and then it was followed by 7, 10, and SBS with no paid TV programs getting a nod, unfortunately. They had a few... They had a few nominations, but no wins.
Now, John, you've I presume as in your media agency days, there's never a shortage of media owners wanting to entertain you.
I presume
you got to walk the red carpet a few times yourself.
Yeah, I did get to walk the red carpet, and it was. Look, I mean, they're great. When you're on the periphery, you sort of take it for what it is. But then when it really gets to party time, you're not part of the occasion, to be frank. But I've waved at the red carpet, raved at the crowd, taken my.
And did the crowd wave back?
Yeah, they did wave back, and so my wife swore the second time or the third time that we wouldn't walk the red carpet again because the adulation was too much, obviously. it is a good night, and from an awards perspective, we do need to recognise, the best, be it in that format or whatever. All the media owners are there, and I've had instances where I've been bailed up by semi-intoxicated CEOs of media companies telling me why did I not spend with them in the toilet.
It's hard to shake hands, isn't it?
The boys find it hard to shake hands in that instance because we're all lined up and you're sort of being berated.
I once had that at an awards do where somebody we had, this is back in the UK, where a media agency where we had got hold of a letter between them and a media owner guaranteeing them a certain kickback we spent, which we put on the front page of the paper.
Oh no!
And then I found myself standing at the very next urinal to this guy. That was an awkward awards moment.
Did you get spoken to?
We did. We chatted actually. We kept it civil, but it was awkward.
I think I just said, look, it's not a time and a place. I'll move on.
Still with the Logies, the build-up did see one unusual moment on the Hamish and Andy radio show on the pre-awards spit roast. The show goes out on the Today Network, which is also home to Kyle Sandilands, so it was perhaps unexpected to hear Charlie bickering with this.
Everyone knows, though, that it's not the project, it's not Hamish and Andy's gap year, it's not Spicks and Specks, it's Australia's Got Talent
AGT.
That everyone wants to
AGT,
win.
AGT. Everyone wants it.
Now, we have on good authority that Kyle Sandilands will not be in the country.
He has another Logies night to go to in Los Angeles.
Yes. upon asking round, AGT would like you to accept it on Kyle's behalf if they in fact win for most popular light entertainment program.
That is great. Can you snap into character and just be Kyle?
Yeah. Hated it.
Would that be your acceptance?
Mate, Australia doesn't have talent. Sorry, every word coming to my head is literally too misogynist to say on the radio.
That's where you failed.
If I'm up accepting the Logie on Kyle's behalf, I'm not going to hold back.
No.
Because I can just blame Kyle. Literally blame Kyle.
Did you just say he sent you the piece of paper? You're just going off at your end?
That would actually be great, just to walk up with the piece of paper.
Yeah, nothing on it.
And just go, Governor General, don't like you, you're a woman.
It's what Kyle.
Anyone notice
might
how
want?
The Prime Minister has a vagina? No, thanks.
First time I think we've had the V word at the spit roast.
Yeah, exactly, followed up by a D&B.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. I've been Kyle Sandilands. Good night.
Next, Australia's interest in the Cannes Film Festival.
This week, Australia's first entrant to the 2012 Cannes Film Festival was announced. Michael, you'll have to help me out with the pronunciation, by the way, Colin. I'm going to go for Spickia.
Yeah, I wasn't too sure if it was Spickia or Spitzia.
Anyway, he's on the Good Oil Films roster and directed the Combank Centenary TV ad and also Crown Lager's Time ad, which was a Droga 5 ad. He's had a short film accepted to the coveted French Film Festival, which comes a couple of weeks before the Cannes Lions, the advertising film festival. Colin, tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if he might be hoping he can make 3 weeks of it and just sort of stretch the holiday over the two festivals. But so the film is called Yardbird. It's produced by Jessica Mitchell, written by Julius Avery, who also wrote and directed Jerry Can, which was a short film that won the Cannes Jury Prize in 2008. It is the story of a young girl who takes on bullies that torment her father. I think I've left a little bit out on purpose because I read a spoiler, but I think there's a little more to the story or to the girl.
Does she turn out to be a superhero?
Yes.
Well, in that case, it was a predictable. In that case, I'm thinking it was probably a predictable spoiler, as I didn't know that.
She wasn't. She may not be. She isn't in latex.
She dead all along.
We're going to have to spoiler alerts on this entire podcast.
Yeah. So Spicchia, let's call him Michael. He's also directed music videos for Jet and Bob Evans. It's the first one to announce. Normally the sort of four or five films, features, short films, documentaries that get into Cannes from Australia.
And anything else from Australasia?
Yes. A film called Night Shift from New Zealand has made it in. And that's from the Curious
Stable,
yeah. Director Izia Mandvilwara.
Easy for you to say.
Yeah. So, yes, good on her as well.
And film box office, what's gone on this week?
Yeah, sure. Box office, it was a quiet weekend after last week's big Easter weekend. So there was only one major release, which was Battleship, which is based on a game and now involves aliens, so go figure. It took 3.9 mil at the box office, and it was followed by American Pie Reunion and The Lorax for a 1-2-3 by distributor Universal Australia, so good effort from them.
Next, an ad break full of milk.
This week, flavoured ice coffee brand Dare bought an entire ad break. The commercial featured comedian Ryan Shelton. Let's take a quick listen.
We interrupt this program for a special-ish announcement. Hi, I'm Ryan Shelton. No, not the Ryan Shelton from Bosnian sitcom Get Down. I do get that a lot, though. But today isn't about me. Today is all about Dare Iced Coffee. Maybe you've seen the ads.
A Dare Iced Coffee fix will fix it.
It certainly is a big promise, but is it true?
Hey, you're the guy from Get Down.
Yep. To find out, I'm joined in this beautiful backyard by this man right here, Brob. Sorry, Rob, is it?
No, it is Brob, with a B.
John, the ad went out at 9 p.m. on Channel 9 during the inexplicably high-rating Big Bang Theory. What sort of investment?
Inexplicably.
Yeah. Really. What sort of investment would that represent, do you think?
Well, so a whole ad break, five city metro.
Well, it ran for 3 minutes.
Your guess is as good as mine. I mean, be part of an... Look, it's a significant investment. I couldn't put a dollar figure to it. I saw the spot and then looked at the spot again. I'm not quite sure what they're trying to do to you guys. You know, it's sort of, I got bored halfway through it, to be frank.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't transcend on radio, but there are a lot of the Dare logo features very heavily. Like they've sort of made sure that, you know, throughout the brand is very apparent.
It's trying to be. It's playing in that space of almost feeling like branded content, isn't it?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah.
You know, clearly it still feels like an ad. But, you know, it's trying to entertain.
Is there a series? Do we know?
Well, Colin, you were talking about this. I understand that they're going to run that ad five times, aren't they?
That's right, yeah. So,
and there are shorter bits that are popping up on YouTube as well.
The identical creative.
Yeah, I believe so. Dare on their Facebook has said if you missed it, it's going to run another five times.
By which time you'll be thoroughly sick of it.
Yeah, hopefully not in the Big Bang Theory. Well, no, hopefully it does, because I don't watch that show. Tim, how does this compare to McDonald's documentary that aired a few weeks ago? We didn't really get to chat about it at the time.
I'd argue this is a different thing, really. So just to recap, the McDonald's documentary, this was where a production company called WTFN, if I remember rightly, was funded by McDonald's to go and shoot some ordinary Australians who had scepticisms about McDonald's as they went on a journey to understand how chips are made. Burgers, etc., etc., and follow a lettuce on its journey from. This is true as well. I'm not making this up. Follow a lettuce on its journey from field to mouth of consumer.
There better be some great personalities in this.
Well,
did it move as slow as an iceberg, or did it rocket there?
Oh, damn.
Boom.
Very nice. I like this.
Yes. Colin will be doing some stand-up comedy somewhere in Sydney soon, and we will announce on this podcast the date when he does his open mic night. The difference with that one being that effectively that documentary was given to Seven for free. You know, money didn't change hands either way on that part of the conversation. So Seven's decision was, is this good content? Now, clearly lots of cynics were saying, and I bet Seven's share of spend from McDonald's has just gone up as part of the deal.
But I think critically the difference is that my understanding of the McDonald's piece is that McDonald's, while they had final veto about whether to run it or not, didn't have editorial control, whereas obviously the Dare commercial break is...
Yes.
Just
100%. Yeah, unashamedly. Yes. Yeah.
So I think we've thoroughly broken down any hope of Colin being able to make a comparison between the two.
I was just
nice
throwing
attempt at an analogy.
I was just a mirror for our readers who did one of which made a comparison to the McDonald's, suggesting it was probably too little, too late, as it had, you know, the media impact had gone on. But they were both...
Speaking of gratuitous.
Yes, they were both pretty gratuitous. Nine's The Block has started again this week, and... They have brand integration.
Oh, I turned on for 2 minutes the first episode of The Block, and the first words I heard from a contestant was, I went into Target and the range was really good, and I was looking around Target and there were so many things from Target I could get. I had no idea until I came in that Target was so good and the pressure was on, and you know, I only had a few minutes in Target, and it was I rang my partner and I said, I'm in Target at the moment, I don't know what to get,
that sounds like the kind of thing that I hear people saying all the time. I don't know what your problem is.
Good on you, Target.
Yeah. But the thing was, it was an unusual thing in that, you know, they now do these, they drop it, you know, it's one of the staples of reality shows now, where they drop in the interviews with the contestants. They're saying, you know, at this point I was really sweating because my souffle wasn't rising or whatever. Mm. It seems to me a new thing where they're actually getting the contestants to plug the brand. You know, that's one more step down integration.
Yeah, well, a bit of consumer speak, you know, consumers speaking to consumers. I think the comment regarding, you know, editorial control versus non-editorial control is relevant. At the end of the day, you know, television companies, media companies, they're in the business of attracting eyeballs. If consumers get turned off by that, they'll react accordingly, you know. Although if they did say it that many times, Tim, I think there'd be someone talking to the producer about it, or the producers having words to sales about it.
John, whose job should it be with branded integration and digital product placement? Is it a media agency thing? Should they be trying to place a product in there? Is it the network trying to... going directly to the client?
I think ultimately the objectives and the communication requirements and the branding requirements from a client need to be assessed and delivered via the relevant agency that's dealing that. So we're dealing with that. So the media agency is ultimately the custodian of that, I'd say. And it goes back to the question, it's strategically got to be relevant.
Next, the lawyer's complaint rejected.
This week, the Ad Standards Bureau decided that a billboard suggesting unsanitary habits in pubs was an acceptable ad. I caught up with our managing editor, Robin Hicks, in the Mumbrella newsroom to discuss the backstory. So, Robin, we do talk about the Ad Standards Board quite a lot, and often you can kind of understand where the complaints come from. This one, an outdoor ad, ad for Carlton Draft, it read, "The Carlton Draft tap, the only tap men use at the pub." Seems fairly harmless.
Yeah, well, I received a call from a lawyer who goes by the initials of JB, who was outraged that the ad seemed to be saying, and I quote, "It's unmanly to wash your hands after going to the toilet." Now, I remember a chat. I remember you were a little bit cross that we ran this story.
Yes, it felt like, why are we going writing something trivial when there's, you know, one person who's complained?
Yeah, why are we writing a story off the back of a single complaint from an apparent madman? I suspected that you're absolutely right until 125 comments later, we had a war beneath our story over whether the complaint was ridiculous and whether indeed he, as a single person, he had the right to complain. Now, Everyone, myself included, thought that the complaint was mad, except for JB, who he was actually taking bets in the comment thread that his complaint would be upheld, if you remember. But obviously the result was that it wasn't. Now, JB is now considering appealing the decision, and he will pay, and I believe he will pay, $100 to complain, because he's so adamant that he's correct.
You can't knock his commitment.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
But that is one of the things about the ASB, isn't it? They have to investigate on a single complaint.
Yes.
And what do you actually count as, you know, the prevailing community standard?
Yeah, and so it's cost the ASB a lot of time and less unnecessary pain, dishing a letter out to this apparent madman. But, you know, I mean, as you mentioned, a single complaint, they have to investigate. Now, a few weeks ago, we saw an anti-animal testing billboard. It was taken down after a single complaint, and the billboard had been up for a whole year. And I thought, I completely disagree with the ASB's decision. So it appears that, you know, ASB can get it right on some occasions, on others not.
On others, they don't agree with you.
Yeah, indeed.
Thanks, Robin.
Cheers.
Next, Harvey Norman gets punked by Green Gorillas.
This week, a group calling themselves Last Stand took on Harvey Norman with the help of QR codes. Creating a promo tag with a QR code for a fake competition and attaching it to products in the Harvey Norman stores, the activists linked the QR code to a video accusing Harvey Norman of using old-growth forests for furniture products. John, are companies fair game for these kind of pranks?
Yeah, most definitely. Yeah, well, you are. It's like saying you're a major celebrity and you can't be open to interrogation by journalists, you know. So they're out there in the public domain. So yeah, definitely. I think it was quite clever, actually.
What would happen to one of these members of Last Stand? And it should be pointed out as well, they put their labels online for other people to print off and attach, and then asked those people to send in photos or upload them to the Last Stand's Flickr site of, you know, what products they've attached
it to. So a total communication integrated approach.
Indeed, yeah, pretty clever. These
hire that person.
Exactly. Yeah. What would happen if one of these guys got caught in a Harvey Norman store? Just ushered out, or are they...
I suppose if you've stuck it on something and actually it's with a sticky enough adhesive you've done damage, then presumably
you could
there's
be
a
done
criminal
for...
damage thing. But if it's harmless, then there's not... If there's no damage, there's not much you can do, really.
I mean,
there?
It gives Harvey Norman an opportunity to respond.
Yeah. Which, interestingly, they chose not to do.
Yeah.
Strange that Jerry wouldn't get up on a soapbox. But anyway, it's not the first time the chain has come under fire from environmental activists. GetUp made this anti-ad last year.
Harvey Norman's massive Aussie forest clearance is on now! We chop down Aussie native forests, ship them to China to make furniture, and then ship the furniture back to you! Don't miss this when you buy imported Harvey Norman furniture. Your Aussie forests slashed! Our Aussie forests are home to unique endangered wildlife. So by destroying these forests, your Aussie wildlife slashed! Our Aussie forests store huge amounts of carbon. And by destroying these forests, this carbon gets released, accelerating climate change. So your Aussie climate slashed! But there is another way. Harvey Norman can use Aussie-grown plantation and recycled timber and manufacture this furniture where? In Australia! This will save our Aussie forests, save our Aussie wildlife, save our Aussie climate. Hurry, take action now and save! Save Aussie forests, save Aussie wildlife, save Aussie climate. Help change Harvey Norman today. Visit noharveyno.net.
No Harvey, no Harvey, no Harvey Norman.
Authorised by Simon Check, Get Up Sydney.
Next, The Voice wipes the shiny floor with AGT.
There's more to radio than music for your headphones.
Radio can connect your brand with consumers in more ways than just over the airwaves. Check out the case study for Nissan Micro Citizen, where listeners were sent to LA, Barcelona and New York to get in sync with the city. Or the interview on how the Lady Gaga deal for Vodafone All-Time Prepaid was done. See that and more at seeradiodifferently.com.
One of the biggest ratings weeks of the year kicked off on Sunday. The Nine Network's new format, The Voice, has been rating over 2 million Metro viewers every night so far. And the return of The Block has also bolstered Nine's share. Meanwhile, over on Seven, Australia's Got Talent has suffered. Its debut episode took under 1.2 million, and the second night didn't reach a million. However, it did recover a bit on Wednesday when it didn't have competition from The Voice. Colin, let's talk formats.
Sure.
The Voice, what do you think?
Look, I watched the Sunday episode with interest. I somehow got sucked into X Factor last year. I'm not a fan of Australia's Got Talent. Partly because I don't like sort of the jumping poodles sort of thing, and partly because I don't like the hosts or the judges. But I wasn't also liking The Voice for the first episode. There was something very weird about the editing, in which after the sort of the singers walked off, there would be this weird banter as if it was live between the judges, despite it being recorded weeks ago. And then I kind of realized that assumedly we are going to get some live version, so they're just trying to keep a sort of similar format.
Yeah.
But it felt a bit awkward. But I've since got into it because you're getting these, you know, the judges can't see who's singing, and you're sitting there like wanting to punch Keith and maybe more so Delta. Well, not really, but you know.
Could I just at this point distance myself and the brand of Mumbrella from those previous comments from my former colleague Colin?
You didn't let me finish. Wanting to punch their buzzers. To have them to punch the buzzers so that they could turn around and take on the singer, who is, you know, a great singer. And, you know, in a few cases, they'd get snapped up because they're also, you know, the full package. They're attractive as well. Other times, there was a woman that was just belting out like Nina Simone. And you're like, why aren't they pressing the button when they're pressing for other people? It became one of those.
You were getting quite into it.
I was, but yes.
Meanwhile, over on Channel 7, poor old Carl Sanderlands was trying to dance on stage with the woman who was impersonating Tina Turner.
Stay classy, Kyle.
Riveting television.
Indeed.
You just went through it, and I'm not a big... Because I look at it from a consumer perspective, I also look at it from a media perspective, and obviously advertisers' ability to utilise those numbers. And when I found something really, really, you know, uninteresting about people not watching a singer, but credit to Channel 9, they have created enough tension within the program, around the program, and to a degree, I think they're back to promoting programs the way they used to many years ago. And I think that had a lot to do.
Now, this is interesting. What do you mean by that? Because I've been thinking a lot about how networks promote their shows.
Yeah, look, I mean, they had this knack of just placing the right type of content that would attract viewers in the right environments of their own network. I can't remember the programs now, but you know, they took on programs that others didn't want, and made them ratings, you know, winners. So with this, like, am I a fan of that particular type of show? No. Did I just sit through the whole thing? Yes. Did I then sit through the next night? Yes. So there are, and I think that, you know, the little Twitter comments at the bottom were, you know, that engages viewers as well. So look, they've done a very good job of that.
And it's been interesting to see it launched in the UK. Obviously the format first launched in the US, but it launched in the UK about a week before it did here in Australia.
Right.
And similar story there. It went up against The X Factor, which is massively popular in the UK, and came close to toppling it in the first week.
Yeah.
And now The X Factor has actually changed its time slot so that the two aren't head-to-head. So it's a format that's clearly working as well.
And even the whole tension around Delta not getting a singer.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, oh, she's not going to get another one. You know?
Yeah. Another question I had regarding the fact that Nine has come up in the last few weeks, or just this week, and they've also got some strong shows.
This ratings week is the week, really.
Yeah. Was it a smart move to leave these shows off for the first quarter of the year? I mean, Seven got a really good stronghold, and when you talk about further down the year, Channel 7's, from that great start that they had, are going to be able to kind of quickly claim number one channel early on.
Don't forget that Nine thought they had the makings of a hit in Excess Baggage. That was the plan for the start of the year. Mm. And obviously they had to bump that over to Go or to Jam because it wasn't rating. So I don't know whether these shows would have been ready any earlier. So that's sort of part of it. And I suppose what it probably now does is it gives Nine some momentum, and it's all about momentum. They've got some momentum now, but it gives them momentum that will probably see them right the way through until the Olympics, which always rates really well for them.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Despite the time slots, it'll again, and then they'll have an opportunity to pre-promote and put other programs. And mind you, the competition is you know pretty strong. I mean, don't forget, Channel 7's still got the football. They've got more programs coming. Channel 10 is. You know, I saw a promotion for something to do with the Bandidos or the Comancheros.
Ah, yes, oh, Brothers Viking. In Arms. Yeah, yeah. Viking Wars. Viking Wars,
it looks very, very strong. Mm-hmm. They're doing that Jersey Shore.
Yes, the Shire. Jersey Shire.
Yeah, I'll end up watching it.
Tim, Celebrity Apprentice has started up again. You were a fan last year. How do you think it will do this year?
I think quite well, actually. I was surprised how disappointingly it rated for the first episode, actually. I was thinking I was going to come in and see it done, you know, 1.4 or 1.5 or something. It actually came in, it was just under a million, wasn't it, Colin?
Yeah, so they sort of split it up into two episodes, and it was just under, like 9.8 and then 9.08, I think.
Yeah, but it was well done. It was very quickly you could see the castings. You know, the last time around it was Demi Hines was the sort of the baddie. This time it's Tania Zayeta, who comes across as a sort of deluded former celebrity. Was very much the joke of the piece with you know, her constantly going on about how she once worked with David Hasselhoff. Very much the kind of the running joke. And then you had her with the I forget the sportswoman, is it Lauren Eagle, is that her name? But who kind of, you know, at one point suddenly just decided to put on a bikini, and then you could sort of see Tanya getting jealous, and then having someone, she was wearing these kind of, you know, full-length dungarees, getting someone just saying, so, it's really hot, would you mind? And giving her a pair of scissors so she could turn them into kind of cut-downs. so it was, there was a lot of comedy there.
How is it that I've missed watching this?
Well, it was great. The one predictability about the format is once you know who the strong characters are going to be, and you see them in the boardroom, you know they're not going to get fired on the first night. So although Tanya was the one who clearly deserved to be fired, you were, you know, it's a bit like on Dragon's Den. The first person who goes in on any given night, you know, is not going to get all the money.
Yeah.
So you knew she wasn't going to get fired. So that added a sort of element of artificiality to it, I suppose. But
just the
it's
one
reality just the TV. One Tim.
Yes,
come on. Yes.
Despite the fact that it's not really Mark Boris's boardroom, but a sound studio at Fox. I think it's at Fox Studios, isn't it?
Yeah,
yeah.
He's quite strong in that though, as a.
I'd say better this series, better than Celebrity.
Yeah,
that first year round, I thought he was pretty bland. Mm-hmm. You know, he certainly wasn't an Alan Sugar or a Donald Trump. But, but there
Sugar's
again,
the best, actually.
There again, he's certainly not Alan Sugar or Donald Trump, I suppose. So that makes sense.
Staying on Nine, Underbelly started filming for a new series. Underbelly Badness will take on the underworld figures Anthony and Andrew Parrish. It's set in Sydney over 10 years from 2001 to 2011. The announcement came just days after Parrish was sentenced to 18 years imprisonment for the murder of Terry Falconer. John, what are your TV viewing habits?
TV viewing habits? Oh, good question. Very sports related. So, but I do try to... The problem with these series is like I try to watch them and stick to them, but I invariably miss bits of them. So I record, you know, or try to buy the video afterwards.
Do you skip ads when you're time shifting?
If I've recorded, yeah. Yeah, unfortunate habit.
That is all we have time for today. Thank you very much to John.
Thank you.
To Kathy.
Thank you.
To Robin. And to Colin.
Thank you.
The Mumbrella Cast was recorded in the studios of CBS Interactive. See you next week. Toodle-pip.